Salutations, Mets fans. Welcome to this week's edition of For All You Kids Out There, the official podcast of your baseball prospectus Mets local site. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro, and with me once again this week is Jarrett Seidler. Jarrett, we kept pushing back recording to try and maybe finagle a show that would start after the Bryce Harper and Manny Machado endless free agent cycle had resolved itself. But here we are late on Monday night, and it has not.
Yeah, so instead we have a Mike Moustakas signing to talk about.
And an Adeiny Echevarria minor league deal.
And we have, I don't know, other stuff.
It is extremely early spring training.
I saw Nick Gage Scott Steiner match.
I saw a Nick Gage Schlack match. GCL doubleheader or GCW doubleheader. No GCL well, doubleheader for us.
The first one was actually ICW.
Oh, whatever.
I saw Nick Gage stab a Nazi. It was very exciting.
Seems very on brand for this podcast.
Yeah.
But we will start with actual Mets news, sort of. Long-time listeners of this podcast might be shocked. We're almost at 150 episodes. It's 149. So if you've been with us since episode one, you might be shocked to learn that the Mets have made an extreme hash of signing a popular player to a long-term deal, Jared.
Yeah. So Jacob DeGrom.
Who wanted to be extended in 2016.
Yes, and still wants to be extended.
Yes, in 2019. Here we are.
It's going to be a lot more expensive.
Yeah. Mets were not interested in 2016. Much to the consternation of Jacob DeGrom's agent at the time, Jarrett.
And us at the time, too. Yeah. You know, it's not my money.
No.
Jacob DeGrom is a good pitcher, man. Yeah, good pitcher, man. The whole, you know, this gets into some much larger conversations in baseball about spending and.
But they should be, like, whatever, we can have a larger conversation, we will, when we get into sort of the current temperature of the Harper Machado free agency. This should be an easy slam dunk for the New York Mets. It's just not going to be. So there was, I think there's a, as often happens when this stuff becomes public, and I won't say nasty, but slightly contentious, seems fair. All these dudes, and they're almost always dudes, come out of the woodwork on Twitter and be like, oh, he's making $17 million this year. He's 2 years from free agency. You know, why would you extend him? Well, you extend him now because if he goes to free agency, you're not re-signing him, and you're getting him for, I mean, functionally, what would probably be two fewer years. If you get a five-year deal here now, but we'll, you know, actually be four fewer years because if he hits free agency, he's probably getting a seven-year contract, which would be take him 9 years from now. Like, he's getting the David Price deal. That's your hometown discount. Yeah. Not hard.
It's just, it's not. This is an easy one, and they're going to screw up the easy one,
And now the best thing is, even if it still gets done, and I think we both think it's still going to get done, they've managed to turn it into a PR kerfuffle and don't get the feel good announce the first day of spring training. We've signed Jacob DeGrom to 5 years and $135 million. Super easy. There's nothing else to write about. So what happens when it goes public like this, they end up writing about this and you do like three press conferences in 48 hours.
Yeah. Do you have awkward Jacob DeGrom being shoot off the stage by, you know, it's not great.
Yeah, it is not. Like, and you know, the fact that it's leaked that they haven't even put together an offer for him is impressive. Like, I get this stuff tends to get done in spring training or at least announced because you have a busy off season to do other stuff, and you know, it hasn't been a busy off season generally, but the Mets did make, you know, certainly more moves in the median major league team. I think I could probably look at it. I saw some report fairly recently that they had actually spent close to the most guaranteed money this offseason outside of the Nats, obviously signing Corbin makes them the front runners. It's going to probably change in the next 48 hours, but you could still probably find someone to put together at least like the framework of an offer, like return his agent's emails at the agency you used to work at. I don't know. That's just me.
Yeah.
Like, what are the arguments for hiring Brody Van Wagenen? Was he has good relationships with a lot of these players? Welp.
He's only recused from the arbitration. All that stuff they said about they had a plan to handle the DeGrom extension without Brody is out the window. He's now running point on it.
Yeah, which it so sure makes when everyone comfortable.
Right, all that shit they told you in November about how this wouldn't be a conflict of interest, blah, 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 was just total horse shit to get through the media cycle.
It's not a conflict of the Mets' interests.
Yeah. Could Brody Van Wagenen at this point get recertified as an agent? Because I'm not sure the answer to that is yes.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I mean, that's
there are any actual rules for this, and Major League Baseball just makes it up as they go along. So,
well, there's MLBPA rules.
Yeah, like the player union might throw a bit of a hissy fit. Probably fairly.
This is a longer discussion than is,
Yeah, we covered. Something. I think we covered a lot of it. We had our good friend Mike Bauman on couple months ago as well.
Yeah.
It's the same issues. They've just cropped up again.
Yep.
Meanwhile, Jacob DeGrom is going out there fully ramped up to try to blow everything he has past Peter Alonso in his first live bullpen. Because that's the way he's wired.
Yeah. One of the arguments to get this done from DeGrom's side earlier, and one of the arguments from the Mets side, one of the reasons teams like to stall this out closer towards opening day is you always have the half dozen pitchers every year that blow out ramping up.
Right, and DeGrom's in a weird spot where if he does, you would normally think there is no way they would possibly non-tender Jacob DeGrom. If he blows out in February 25th, he probably does get non-tendered, given his particular... salary for this year and the maximum cut he would get in ARB next year and the amount of service time he has left. Maybe the Mets would work out but the Mets will say, oh, we can work out something else. Some other team will come in and give him an extremely lucrative version of the Michael Pineda rehab with us for a year contract.
Yeah, and I mean, if he blew out on February 25th, he might even be back by April or May next year. So, but it certainly puts a lot, him having to ramp up certainly puts a lot of risk on himself. It's a weird one. Yeah. This shouldn't have gotten this far. It just shouldn't have.
The Mets.
This was an easy one, and they blew it. Layup. And they'll probably fix it, but
they might not. What would you put the odds that this just doesn't get done this year?
35%.
Maybe. I would say 25. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they end up being too far apart on money.
I mean, so. The framework that was being discussed, and whoever was talking to Mets blog, was 5, 130 to 145, which seems like I think that would get it done. It seems like that would get it done if that framework actually existed.
Yeah,
I think. The reason that Jacob DeGrom was facing Pete Alonso in his first live BP earlier today is that Pete Alonso specifically requested to face Jacob DeGrom.
So, yeah, I mean, hashtag Greg.
Of course. Right? As much as that, really shouldn't matter, I guess, from an evaluative perspective, it kind of does.
So the thing is, it does, from a PD perspective, actually matter.
Yeah.
It's just seeing it from the outside is really tough, outside of, like, the real edge cases. And I don't even know if Alonzo is up to the point of being, like, a real edge case. You know, and edge cases, I'm, like, talking, like, you know, there are certain dudes that we hear really nuclear makeup stuff on.
Jordani Valdesven.
Yeah, there's an example of a guy. Sure, there you go. Been long enough that we can talk about that, right?
I feel like it's been a recurring theme on the show, so sure.
Yeah. It's difficult to know what's real, what's BS, you know, what's a narrative versus what's the reality.
I mean, all you heard internally, for one example, is the Mets gushing about Luis Yorme's makeup, and they go and sign a Danny Hecheverria, so.
Yeah, I guess we gotta talk about that too, right?
Well, let's finish up with Alonzo, because we have full report now, of course, and Peter Alonzo, who does like to, who is not shy with a quote, is very available. Let's say he's very available to the press.
As he always is.
Came out and said that, you know, sort of reiterated what he said towards the end of last year. From everything he's heard, they're going to give him a shot to win the opening day first base job. Brody Van Wagenen reiterated that. Mickey Callaway said he was incredibly improved defensively. Speaking of, like
opening day first baseman is still going to be Todd Frazier.
We're both fine with the Mets breaking camp with Peter Alonzo as the opening day first baseman.
Yeah.
But that's not the kind of stuff you want to say if you don't plan on doing that.
Well, I guess you're, and this ends up being weird, perverse disincentive. You actually want him to have bad spring training now, right?
Yeah.
Right, so you can justify sending him down because you know, you know, it really doesn't mean anything if he hits like 240 or whatever.
I mean, no more than it means if he hits 400 with power.
Right. But if he hits the 240 with moderate power, all of a sudden it becomes very easy to send him down.
Yeah.
And you also like really want Todd Frazier to hit a lot during spring training, so you could say. Because like last offseason, and I discussed this on Twitter a little bit, there was theoretically supposed to be a three-way competition in camp between Brandon Nimmo, Dom Smith, and Adrian Gonzalez for the first base / right field job because Jay Bruce could have played either.
Yeah.
And the obvious, by far, winner of that competition was Brandon Nimmo. They carried him for the first week of the season. He didn't play, and they sent him down.
Yep. Those are things that happened, which I also feel like got discussed on this podcast. And very.
It was a fake competition. It was rigged for Adrian Gonzalez to win. And they said it was an open
And funnily enough, the year before that, the only reason Brandon Nimmo didn't make the opening day roster over Michael Conforto is that he got hurt playing for Team Italy.
Yes.
The Mets.
But they can say it's an open competition all the time.
Yeah.
You know, Brandon Nimmo was arguably the best player in camp last year and still didn't win what was supposed to be an open competition with a clear path for playing time for him.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even a guy they were trying to manipulate service time on.
Nope.
You know, I think they've been very clear that they view Todd Frazier as an everyday starter somewhere.
Yeah.
And the only spot for him to be an everyday starter right now is that first base spot.
I mean, they can play him at third and Lowry at first, I guess. I don't think they'll do that.
Right, but it's that spot, whether it's in that configuration or not.
Yeah.
Until somebody gets hurt.
Which might happen in spring training, as it often does.
Right. And, you know, I think for that, like, backup corner spot, I'm going to much rather prefer to carry J.D. Davis and be long for many, many reasons.
Yeah. And we'll get to J.D. Davis, because there is a full roundup of the Terry and March news in a bit. I did see some Alonzo BP, and, like, it really is kind of amazing how much he has rebuilt his swing since we saw him in the Penn League a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's not entirely uncommon.
It's like right-handed, the comp I use, and this is not strictly a comp, mind you. It's a little like right-handed Kyle Tucker. It's sort
just
of his setup,
like
and his setup and load Kyle, is, yeah. That's a good one, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're going to have that kind of swing and setup, it's going to be an opposite field power setup.
Yeah.
But he drives the balls in power alley and brings that center. You know.
I mean, that power plays to all fields.
Yeah.
And, like, it's not, so the thing is, like, it's not a super quick bat, but he's shortened up so much and he's so strong that it doesn't even, like, matter.
Pretty quick bat.
It's a pretty quick bat, but it's not, like, you know, crazy elite bat speed or anything.
No, he's not
passing by. He's got levers still, because he's a big dude.
Yeah.
I'm talking myself into Pete Alonso, man. It's your influence.
Yeah.
He's also like
I've influence in the prospect ranking community.
Yeah. Much to the consternation of many, including myself.
Yeah.
But yeah, like we've discussed this on and off. I think when we had David on too, like it's really we're naturally cynical. Sarcastic, nattering nabobs, and you know, as I've remarked many times over the years, we're in 6 years now of podcasting, well over 300 episodes, probably conservatively 750 hours of talking into my Yeti Blue. I guess it wasn't always that. I had a little headset thing. I had a Logitech when I first started out. I have, in almost all cases, been chatting with you or various other people with various, you know, New Jersey to Long Island accents about bad Mets baseball. In some cases, incredibly unfun bad Mets baseball.
You want to get Rob Castellanos on this podcast one of these days?
He was one of the lesser charming regional accents. You know, Steve Saipa, very
Greg Karam,
a classic.
We should get Greg back on these
yeah,
days.
Yeah, he's popped into Mason Avenue Slack on and off. Also trying to troll me in my BP chats. I see you, Greg.
He popped in at our event.
Well, that's right. He did. He did show up to our hot stove event. It's good to see him. But you know, generally speaking, I've just been a miserable git about the terrible Mets baseball I've had to watch and form opinions about. With you know, some exceptions, there have been bright spots, and sometimes you know it's a player, sometimes it's the second half of 2015, but generally, it has not been fun. Like, by all accounts, you know, guys like Peter Alonso, even Jed Lowry, you know, Sugar Diaz, certainly, aesthetically, mwah, chef kissing fingers. Like, this should be a fun Mets team in 2019. But I'm like, I just still feel like I can't, like, fully embrace it because I'm just waiting for the shoe to drop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have nothing to add to that.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. It's good that I'm back a little bit. Rambly and ranty, I think we were discussing recently.
You gotta mix it up.
We do have to mix it up. I think some very good whiskey is what the cocktail I poured for this.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be a Mets camp without our first injury scare. And it was almost a bad blow for the brand, Jarrett, as Steve Valines, hashtag Valines Club, took a comebacker off the leg from Mark Bientos in his first live BP session.
Yeah, I mean, he's fine.
He's fine. Is this just an excuse to make an argument for Steve Valines to make the opening day bullpen?
Ooh, that's aggressive. That's
is
aggressive.
That's going to be like Kyle Doughty and Hector Santiago.
I mean,
they've been extremely not aggressive with him, so.
Yeah, Valines is pretty much the only, which is actually a type of guy that's kind of disappearing from bullpens.
He's got a good changeup, though. Like, he can cross over.
Alright. I guess he can do multi innings when paused.
Let's.
I don't know how like a sidearm, you know.
We'll do some important and useful research here and look up Steve Alein's minor league splits from last year.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm guessing
they're not great.
I don't have any information. I don't have the information. I'm about to have the information.
I already
he had no splits, essentially.
Yeah. But also, like, do we really care about A-ball pitching splits and a relief?
No, but I mean, he had a 5-1 strikeout to walk ratio against left-handed batters. He struck out 53 of the 115 left-handed batters he faced.
Yeah. Pretty good.
He's pretty good. I mean, against righties, he had a 43-3 strikeout to walk ratio.
I think he's a better midseason candidate. I think he's going to open back and bang up.
But like, my thing is, yeah, I guess, but also like, there's no reason he shouldn't have been like in AAA by the end of last year and BA. Like, he's not the profile's not changing here. He was a senior sign.
So, I mean, so his ERA in the Sally was like ugly early in the season, and I think they just felt they couldn't promote him until it came back down to a...
I mean, he shouldn't have started in the Sally.
That is also a truth.
17-2 strikeout to walk ratio and 11 late season innings in bingo. I think I saw him twice too. And he shoved, man. I know it's like 85 to 88.
It's a really fringy fastball. It is. Really fringy.
The breaker's worse than that too, so.
Right. I mean,
I don't know how, like, it's one of those things, like I said this since I saw him in Brooklyn last year. I don't know how he does it. But it just works.
But what, I mean...
Yeah, whatever, like, he's not...
Are we talking game. Like Pat Neshek before the velocity jump here? Like, is that what we're hoping for here?
Chad Bradford?
What does Chad Bradford look like in late 2010s baseball?
I mean, like... Look, I don't know if it's going to work in the majors, but like... Yeah, he just shoves his stuff in people's faces and they swing and miss. It just works, man. I don't try to figure it out. Like, I don't have like any deeper analysis of like Steve Alein's stuff. I've seen him a lot, but like,
So here's the thing.
Yeah.
This is not Mets related, but we did say we would talk about Mike Moustakas.
We did.
Planning on moving him to second instead of Shaw.
Yeah, no, I know.
Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah.
What does that have to do with the Lions Club? I am going to get t-shirts made up, I think. I just have to...
Got to get somebody to design
the... Yeah, Lucas, Steve, and I have been arguing over the design for it.
So I'm thinking...
So I'm going to go with like the low arm slot instead of like the crossbone... thing.
Yeah, I was going to do, like, two low arm slot angles. Yeah.
I don't know what to do, like, in the middle for it, though.
So, have you seen the Villain Enterprises logo? I think you actually designed after the Villain Enterprises logo.
Let me see. I haven't seen that one yet. That's not
bad. Yeah. But you do the Villain, you know, the Lions Club at the top instead of Villain Club. Instead of Villain Enterprises or Villains Club, I think he designed it after.
Let's take a look at Pro Wrestling Tees. Oh, yeah. I like that. Yeah. That's actually good. It's a good logo.
Except, obviously, you have the
Lions Enterprises. Yeah.
Hmm. I would still do the Lions Club.
The Lions Club.
I'm just saying, you do like the crossed arms, like the crossed arm.
Let's look at the entire range of Marty Skrull. Awesome radio. You know what we could do? We could do it off the Mind of a Villain one, where it's a picture of Steve Lyons, like SV on the John Lennon glasses, and two, instead of the two birds sticking out of his head, it's two side-arming dudes.
That's like too obscure. Like you want to keep, I think you want to
I
keep
guess you
like the
have to use like the
Bullet
main
Club
Bullet
motif.
Club
Yeah, I think you
model
want to keep
for
the
it.
Bullet Club motif.
We can't
Yeah.
do Steve Lyons riding an old-fashioned bicycle.
I mean, you can, just
Yeah.
nobody will get it.
Yeah, I know, I know. They don't have any of the. I wonder if they don't. If they're moving away from, like, the.
Yeah, the ball club stuff's all
All
gone
gone, yeah.
off PWGs. You can still get it at Hot Topic, though.
Sure. Well, that was a fun divergence. You want to talk about Mike Moustakas?
Oh, we gotta talk about. I think we already did talk about Mike Moustakas, essentially. He's
Yeah.
gonna be playing second base apparently for the Brewers, which is gonna be interesting.
It does keep every Brewer signing does knock that Cubs pagoda projection down a little lower, Jarrett.
Yeah.
I'm here for it. I almost wish they'd sign Machado if he can get down to 78 or 77.
That's not going to happen. He's signing in San Diego or maybe the White Sox.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I'd like at least one other sign. Hey, Cardinals signed Dallas Keuchel. Feels like a good fit.
What's he get?
No, I'm saying to. I'm talking about
Oh,
scenarios that would move the Cubs' pagoda projection down
I thought
further.
you actually meant that,
No.
like, is breaking that.
But see,
Okay.
you believed it, so it's credible.
Yeah, sure.
Seems like it might be a soft landing spot for him. Cardinals could sign Kimbrel too. I can see that.
Yeah. I mean, the Reds could sign any of these guys too,
Yeah, the
right?
Reds have had a very weird offseason in
What do you think
general,
about
so.
opening day center fielder Nick Senzel? Because that's apparently going to be a thing.
It's bold.
Fortune favors the bold.
At least might get them to 81 wins, which is more than we're projecting for the Cubs.
79 wins.
Cubs Twitter is not happy.
Has Cubs Twitter ever been happy with Baseball Prospectus as an organizational entity?
That is a good question. Probably not.
So we gotta talk about
Not in
it.
my recent memory, certainly.
So we gotta talk about a deity, right?
Adani Echevarria, yes. This is going to be a little. If you haven't guessed it already, listeners, be a bit of a scattershot show. Jarrett and I are. I don't know what's the
Dealing
best.
with Baseball Prospectus prospect team administrative tasks
Yeah. Fair enough.
that have kept us very busy for the last couple of weeks and will continue to do so through the rest of this week.
That's.
We're doing a hiring process, so we got a lot of resumes, and
Yeah.
if you sent one in, you may have heard back from us already. If not, you'll be hearing back from us pretty soon. We're still kind of sorting through everything. But that we got
This is
almost triple
literally
the
the
amount
only
of.
time I will ever say this in
Yeah.
my life. But I miss Craig because he would just handle this shit.
We had a number that we were expecting based on the last couple of years that we thought, would be about the number, and the number of applications we got was nearly triple that. So,
Echevarria signed a minor league deal with the Mets that will get him, if he's in the majors, $3 million plus.
okay, so I'm of several
Playing
minds.
days of service bonuses. I don't remember if days of services or at bat bonuses, but whatever. Up to like $5 million, I think.
Okay, so I have several thoughts here.
Yeah.
Adani Hechavarria is overqualified to be taking an NRI with a team that has a obvious starting shortstop.
Sure.
He's also a really bad fit to be on an NRI for the Mets specifically.
Sure.
They can't carry him,
They can't. They
and
don't have a spot for him, yeah.
they have this player as an optionable 40-man player already. He's basically the same guy as Luis Guillorme.
Right.
He's not even a particularly better version of Luis Guillorme. His ability is essentially to provide bulk starting at bats at shortstop.
Right.
Which they don't need.
They do not.
They don't need bad bulk starting at bats. He's more qualified to be Alcides Escobar than Alcides Escobar is at this point.
He probably would have been the opening day shortstop for the Orioles if his agent got him there before Alcides Escobar.
Right. And it's just like...
I mean, it's fine if you're going to... like.
Right, but he's not
going on the 40. You keep him in Syracuse. But also, like, you probably want Guillorme playing every day shortstop in Syracuse.
Yeah.
And so that
Syracuse infield was already, like, way too crowded. Yeah.
As you might be well aware, the Mets signed every second baseman possible this offseason. You got Delson Herrera.
Right, like, is Gavin Cecchini going back to Bingo or something here?
I don't know. You had Gavin Cecchini, TJ Rivera, Delson Herrera, Guillorme bouncing around that middle infield, Echeverria. Am I forgetting anybody? Probably they signed some rando, like, infield, outfield utility minor league free agent, too, in there.
I mean, yeah, hold on a second. One can look these things up. Phil,
they can.
15 seconds, please. JD Davis might end up down there too, right?
He does have an option, but he's not really a middle infielder.
David Thompson is who you forgot.
David Thompson is third. I was thinking more second shortstop, but sure.
Oh, you forgot Danny Espinosa.
Danny Espinosa, there.
Did we mention Delson Herrera?
Yes, I did. Where are they playing all these people?
And also, they also traded for Sam Haggerty.
Oh, that's right, they did. He's going to be in Binghamton, I think, though.
I would think so. But like, then in Binghamton, you're going to end up with Luis Carpio.
Yeah.
You're going to end up with Blake Tabiri, maybe.
We haven't mentioned Andres Jimenez yet.
Yeah, Andres Jimenez, who's like the actual prospect. Michael Paez might be there.
Sure, you like Michael Paez more than I do. But this is bizarre. Like, you're blocking Andres Jimenez. I mean, you're not really, but... like, if, like, you don't, like, what do you do with a Danny Echeverria?
And when the
Danny
Mets
Espinosa,
do this...
some of these guys have opt-outs, I assume, but...
yeah, I mean, I assume Echeverria...
like, their outfield depth is still somehow, like, Tim Tebow. I know they have Braxton Lee and Rajay Davis, too, but it'd be a very good Syracuse team.
Yeah, Gregor Blanco, you forgot Gregor Blanco.
God, where are they playing all these people?
Don't know. We also forgot the NRI'd Reimer Liriano.
Yeah, that's fine. He's a corner outfielder. Like, that's... this is wild.
Yeah. I don't...
I know we complained the Mets never had depth, but first of all, most of these guys aren't even real major
league
depth.
This is not the right kind of depth.
Not the right kind of depth.
Yeah.
Danny Espinosa is the right kind of depth.
Right. Like, this is not... if you're and Mickey has been absolutely clear, he is not carrying less than 13 pitchers, and JD Davis isn't going to count as the 13th pitcher. So you're already playing with a short bench. You cannot in 2019 baseball have a short bench with a guy like Adani Hecavaria on it. He's a terrible fit as a bench player. His entire value is being able to go out there and pick it at shortstop.
Right.
They have a guy who should be starting, 12 games every 2 weeks at shortstop that might need a day, one day off a month.
And they have backfield. They can play Jed Lowry there. They can play Jeff McNeil there. It's fine.
Right. Like, you're afraid on his one day off a month that you won't be able to recall Louis Guillorme, or you can't just stick Jed Lowry or Robinson Cano or Jeff McNeil or Todd Frazier out there for 5 innings on his day off.
Yeah.
Or if, he gets hurt. Like, the idea that you have to carry... this is 1990s roster construction on a 2020s bench, that you have to carry a glove man backup shortstop even though you have no actual need for it.
Omar Quintanilla wasn't even that good defensively.
Right. But this is like that. And the Mets believe this.
Yeah.
This is something that the Mets organizationally have believed, that you have to carry one of these guys on the major league roster. And it's one of the reasons their benches have fucking sucked. And if they send down J.D. Davis to carry... J.D. Davis can be the dude that stands at shortstop and plays at bat if you really want. Like, they played Eric Campbell at shortstop once.
Speaking of podcast I had about bad, miserable Mets teams. Yes, I feel like I've discussed that before.
Yeah.
This has been a lovely first half so far. We do have to do a Terry and Mark to wrap up, which of course is, technically speaking, Mickey in February, but you get the general gist of it. The most recent one is that he's very excited to see Kyle Dowdy, who has four pitches, which I was aware of, and could be an important major league piece, Jarrett.
Sure.
Yeah. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I mean,
I want to be clear. I think he was a intriguing Rule 5 selection. It's definitely worth bringing him into camp and giving him a shot.
Sure. I agree with that.
I just think they might be less willing to cut bait than they probably should be.
The Mets, I mean, yeah. You know, we all remember the Brad Emus experience where they Rule 5 Brad Emus, and they decided before they came into camp that Brad Emus was a major league player and needed to receive significant playing time. And he stunk, and they eventually sent him back after they realized he really stunk, and nobody ever heard of him again.
Do you know who, do you remember who they slotted in after Brad Emus got sent back?
Was that Jordani Valdez fiend?
It was Justin Turner. Took over for him.
Yeah.
Beat him out for that job eventually in May. My concern is we're going to look up at, like, they're going to give him like 25 really bad innings between the beginning of the season and May 15th, pitched like a 6 ERA. If it goes that way, they're not going to cut bait quickly.
Yeah. I mean, it concerns me. And I also don't care what his ERA is like in spring training or the first week of the season. I care what he looks like. Mm-hmm. And
so the other major news of the week is there were some significant starting pitching extensions. Both Aaron Nola and Luis Severino extended for similar structured deals. A little bit different because they're at different points in their service time. And Nola let the Phillies buy out a few more free agent years. But it did come up in our Facebook group that this could be a model for a Noah Syndergaard extension, Jarrett.
Nope.
Not going to happen. I'm sure the Mets can offer that.
And I'm sure Noah Syndergaard will have some choice choice words, if that's what they... So the difference here is that Syndergaard, because he's a super two and has already been through a year of arbitration, like, isn't, like, dirt poor. They have passed the period where they can leverage Syndergaard being dirt poor, just like they did with Jacob DeGrom, but that period's already gone.
And I mean, so I guess Nola's probably the better comp because they got similar bonuses. Nola was a higher draft pick, so got a little more.
Yeah.
And they both sort of had vague, not like serious arm issues, but, you know, not insignificant arm issues. Sure. You know, Severino's his own beast because he was, I don't think he got a ton as an IFA, right? He was like a low six-figure guy.
I think it was five-figure, but yeah. He was not a seven-figure guy.
Right. And he, you know, had arm issues. Again, vague, but not insignificant arm issues. More before he came up to the majors, so you can read into the second half of last season for him as you see fit. But like, yeah, Syndergaard is going to be a dude that bets on himself. I'm not saying he wouldn't extend. He's not extending for this.
Yeah.
So that's the first half of the show, Jarrett. This is, even by our standards, loose and scattershot.
That's one way to put it, sure.
It's a quality product that you can expect week in and week out during the season from For All You Kids Out There.
Yeah.
For now, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll do our usual other half of the show nonsense. Welcome back. Now it's time for the second/third half of the show. before we do that, we do housekeeping. This is For All You Kids Out There, episode 149. For All You Kids Out There is a baseball prospectus Mets adjacent podcast. How the hell did I introduce the show? I did not mention any of this at the outset. Like I said, a little loose. You can find us on the internet at baseballprospectus.com. Podcast is on iTunes. Just search for All You Kids Out There and you listen or subscribe right there. I encourage you to do both. I also encourage you to rate and review the podcast. Maybe not this week, though. If you want to get in contact with the show, we're on Twitter at For All You Kids. Jarrett's on Twitter at J.A. Seidler. I'm on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. We have a Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/For All You Kids Out There. And you can email the show at allyoukids@baseballprospectus.com. We do have a couple Facebook queries. So I'll read them out now as I scroll down. Question for the pods is from David. When you look at a pitcher and determine his aging curve, what are the factors you use? This obviously is in relation to DeGrom and how effective he can remain going into his mid-30s. So I'm going to take a slightly backwards approach to this. I'll go back to sort of like pitching prospects in general. And I think we consider age relative to league less for pitchers than we do for hitters, Jarrett.
I think that's pretty safe to say, sure.
And of course, DeGrom being a classic example of a dude that was over age for every level. Maybe not a great example of that not being significant as a prospect, because the stuff was, as we've discussed before, very different for him as a prospect than it was in the majors. But I think aging curve, like, so it's the old, what's the old Joe Posnanski line? Time is undefeated.
Yes.
But if you were going to project a right-handed pitcher to do well aging into his 30s, I think it both would and wouldn't be Jacob DeGrom in a way. You know, we've seen Jacob DeGrom, you know, as recently as 2017, have a fair bit of success working with less velocity. Like, we never got a full explanation for that. If it was just general soreness, dead arm period. But, you know, he had starts that year where he was more, you know, 92 to 95 and was still an above average major league starter.
Right.
You know, he's not a guy where if he loses, you know, 2 to 3 miles an hour off his fastball, it's going to be the end of him. You could certainly see him falling back on being more of a pitch mix guy, you know, working his off-speed stuff in, working backwards more. And he'll do this at times even when he has his good fastball, just to give guys a different look, second time through the order and stuff like that. You know, he's obviously a very good athlete. The frame is more or less ideal. He keeps himself in very good shape, yada, yada, yada. You know, he has had a Tommy John surgery. That is a concern. You know, he had to go in and have a ulnar nerve surgery as well recently. And the best predictor of future pitcher injuries is past pitcher injuries. He's also, you know, he's also a second Tommy John surgery away from being a very, very, very volatile profile.
Sure.
Because it's not just like his first Tommy John surgery. You know, all that said, you know, the aging curve for pitchers, sort of the general sabermetric orthodoxy here is that pitchers peak earlier. But I think that's like whatever the opposite of survivorship bias is, functionally. You know, pitchers peak earlier because enough pitchers break that they don't have sort of that tail to their career as much as hitters do. So when you look at them as a, you know, macro zoom out at the pitching population, it looks like they peak earlier. You know, obviously Jacob DeGrom was not that dude. Jacob DeGrom has had more or less sort of the traditional, you know, it sure looks like he's in the middle of the traditional age 28 to age 32 peak right now, Jarrett.
What do you think about the idea that he might not age well because he's extremely reliant on high fastballs now?
I mean, so yes, but also it's not like he couldn't change that because the secondary stuff is so good. It's like a 70 slider.
Right.
And the curve and the change are both, you know, if not plus, at least solid average.
I mean, so if you're thinking about a pitcher this is a weird comp. You know, similar stuff that's obviously aged very well, although not evenly. You know, Justin Verlander.
Sure.
Would be the argument, too, that he might age pretty well. But, you know, the argument on the other side is Yu Darvish.
Yeah. I mean, Corey Kluber's not a great comp outside of
Stetson. You
know, outside of Stetson and sort of, you know, late bursting on the scenes. But if you look at, you know, he's 2 years older than DeGrom, and his age 31 and age 32 seasons were worth over 10 wins. So, and then if you get that, like, I feel like a 10-win projection from DeGrom for the next 2 years is not overly aggressive, let's say. Might even skew conservative, you could argue. And if you're getting that, you're already most of the way towards his paying off his 5-year extension. You know, I don't know what his 30s look like. I know he's a very good athlete. He's actually somewhat low mileage because he was a, you know, position player for as long as he was. I don't think there's any, like, hard and fast rules here.
Yeah, I mean, it would be kind of high variance to extend him. But I don't know that the Mets shouldn't be embracing that anyway.
I mean, they clearly are, just they won't admit to it.
Yeah.
I mean, high variance has been the Mets' ethos, again, about as long as I've been doing this podcast. And others like it.
And also, if you're going to do that, like, wouldn't you go try and sign Bryce Harper? I don't know. I guess that's a high variance.
That's expensive.
You can have high variance, but you can't have high variance and expensive.
Right.
Yeah.
Clearly, I don't have a concise answer for you, David, but I probably don't have a particularly satisfying one either. Nick wants to know, is Chrissy Teigen somehow finding herself in E. Holt's mentions of all people the weirdest things that ever happened on Mets Twitter? Nick, to you I say, is this your first day on Mets Twitter?
So what actually would be the...
The weirdest thing to happen on Mets Twitter? Man...
Is it the Daniel Murphy cream pie tweet?
That's not that weird, though, I feel like.
That's pretty weird.
It's pretty weird, but yeah. I mean, there was literally the dude that got arrested for, like, threatening LaTroy Hawkins' family. I guess that's not weird.
Yeah, that's serious fucked up.
And that's also
try to keep it light, dear.
Big fan kind of plot point stuff, so... Every fan base has those unfortunate people. The weirdest thing to happen on Mets Twitter. I've lived so many lifetimes on it, and like nothing's really...
I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff that's happened on Mets Twitter.
It's true.
I just don't know. It's kind of a weird...
I mean, you have the whole, like, weird Noah Syndergaard trying to turn Mr. Met into a fishmonger, so there's that.
Yeah.
There was the Mr. Met flipping off the fans and the statement that came out afterwards.
Yes.
That was good. Let's see what else. Weird Mets Twitter stuff. there was the passing around the congratulations baby shower card for John Buck's wife because it got Travis d'Arnaud called up. That was the thing that happened. I think I even signed that because Maggie was passing it around on the Shaver Ridge at some point.
Non-elite prospect,
which apparently I invented.
Yes, non-elite prospect Mike Nicky, yes.
I mean, I feel like that particular like trade stuff wasn't the weirdest thing. Like, it was just the normal kind of trade progression things. Like, it wasn't all that unusual. I feel like that kind of happened around the Beltran for Wheeler deal as well. In various formats.
I missed this one because I was having surgery when this happened, but the Keith Hernandez Julius Salazar incident.
Oh my god! Just like
fantastically interesting.
Yeah, that was the thing that happened.
It was maybe just because it was a cross section of
relevant to your interests.
That was
the thing that happened. That's a good shout. It's not a bad shout, actually.
That is, yeah.
What would have been, like, historically, what would have been the weirdest day on Mets Twitter, if Mets Twitter existed back through the history of the Mets?
The Kenny Rogers game might have caused, like, actual deaths.
I mean, it almost killed me, God knows.
Yeah.
And I was young and spry then. Maybe the brawl in Houston? Was it in Houston?
Now, this kind of happened around the beginning of Twitter, but I think if it had happened in, like, 2019, it would have been much different, would be the Adam Rubin has lobby.
Oh, God, yeah. That's true.
Yeah. Like, if Adam Rubin has lobby happened in, like, the last 2 or 3 years, my God.
Burn the website to the ground. Probably should do
that. Right. Like, because 2010's, like, kind of early enough.
Yeah, it was, like, there wasn't really...
Right, it was, like,
still, San Diego Chargers were still tweeting about P.F. Chang's and whatnot.
Right, like, John Heyman was making, like, earnest tweets about Don Mattingly getting into the Hall of Fame. He hadn't discovered Arby's Twitter yet.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Oh, you know what it is? Bobby Valentine coming back out in the disguise.
Oh, yeah, because that's even...
Yeah.
That's a meme now. It's
like, yeah, yeah.
Late, you know? Jay Horowitz was tweeting. We forget about that. Sandy Alderson tweeting. That was, like, long enough ago. But, I mean, Jay Horowitz was doing some truly bizarre tweeting for a while.
Yeah.
Like, he was, like, unintentional weird Twitter. Just actually,
right? Him and, like, Iron Gazi, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like,
Jay indistinguishable.
Horowitz, right, like, Jay Horowitz's Twitter was, like, it could have been drill.
Grant Roberts smoking a bong.
Would it shock you if Wint was Jay Horowitz?
Yes, a little bit, for a variety of reasons.
I mean, but it's, like, just, like... I-O-W-E-R here, thank you, what great seats, see you later.
This is not specifically designated as a question for the pod, but it's relevant to our interests, so I'll bring it up. It's from Justin. Anyone else see High Flying Bird, the new Soderbergh movie on Netflix? For all we talk about potential work stoppages in MLB, and even what Cody and the Young Bucks have been able to do to create their own promotion, I think a lot of folks here would dig it. So I have not watched it yet. I'm familiar with the basic plot line. So this is like my wonky film student past. Really don't like Soderbergh as like a stylist. So I tend to...
I've never like seen a Soderbergh movie that I actually liked.
Yeah, that's kind of like where I... So the joke I used to make many years ago, was it? My favorite Soderbergh film is, fuck. It's actually a George Clooney film. It's the one about, I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head now. It's the one about the dude from the game show that thought he was a CIA assassin. I'm gonna look this up now. Yeah, from the Gong Show, that's what it was. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. Which actually is quite good. And is, like, obviously an homage to Soderbergh, because Clooney had worked with him a lot by that point. But that's, like, my favorite Soderbergh film. I also saw Sex, Lies, and Videotape when I was 15, because I'm that kind of film student. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind is also a Charlie Kaufman screenplay. But yeah, Soderbergh's stuff generally doesn't do much for me. And he, like, shoots everything on the iPhone now, which I don't love. Are you familiar with the movie at all, Jarrett?
I am not, no.
So the premise of it is that an NBA first-round draft pick is drafted. There's a lockout that goes on for a while. His agent is feeling pressure because he's, like, his one client. So sets up a bunch of, like, one-on-one games for him that start, like, selling out. And it's like, so it's basically, it's a movie about basketball players seizing the means of production, essentially. But you would like it. It's all about, like, sports labor and stuff like that.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen it yet. But I've seen very good reviews. I'll probably end up watching it because it does certainly fit with the tenor of this podcast. And I will break my general rule about, like, I guess I should say I appreciate Soderbergh's existence as a filmmaker. I just find his stuff not particularly to my taste, would be the best way to put it.
Sure.
Anything else? So we had a question, not as such. I got asked this, and it was asked not to use it on the pod, but I'm going to use it on the pod anyway, and not name the person that asked me. Yeah. It's fine.
I know who did, and they're not going to be happy, but okay, continue.
So the question was just sort of like, and this is relevant because we had a full Tim Tebow press conference this week, and this is our, you know, we've been dealing with this now for about 30 months at this point. You know, at what point does the Tim Tebow signing become worth it from a baseball point of view?
I mean, it's a $100,000 pool exempt draft guy.
Like, right. So it's like, it's like, literally essentially like a pool rando college pick in the 25th round.
Right. It's like a senior signed college dude. It's like if he, like, you know, already is there, they already got like a useful half season of AA out of him.
Right. So, like, teams will tell you, scouts too, and I've had this conversation with various people over the years. And there are some teams that will literally not let you submit a player to be drafted, even if you're not going to be pounding the table until the 25th round, if you're not throwing a major league grade on him.
Yeah.
Which personally I think is a dumb way to do it. You sort of got to be realistic about what the draft is.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But, you know, by the same token, if you're, like, if... So who are the dudes we've generally thought Tebow has been taking spots from over the year? I know you wrote a piece about Stephen Sable.
Yeah.
For one example. And, like, Sable being a... I don't remember if he was a DES or if he was technically a JUCO guy. He was a JUCO guy. And he got fairly decent money. But, you know, he made it to Double A and actually didn't hit all that much better or worse than Tebow at that level. He hit 229, 316, 362 as a 24-year-old in Binghamton in 2016, which feels like it should have been longer ago than it actually was, but whatever.
Sure.
you know, I think he got a little bit more money because he got, like, an overslot as a 17th-round JUCO pick. And he got, like, 350 or something like that. Eudipino was another one, I think, that came up. Timeline fit? No, it's too early. No, because he was in Double A, 2015. So it wasn't Eudipino. Who's the guy after Eudipino? Actually, yeah, I should just look up.
John Urania, but yeah.
Johan Urania. I mean, it's not even Johan. I mean, he might still actually make it. Look at that 2016 Binghamton team, because I feel like that's going to be about where it was. Let's see. Yeah, I think Victor Cruzado actually stuck around another year. But, like, even it was Mikey De La Cruz. There's a name.
Yeah.
You know, again, got to double A, didn't hit a ton. I'm guessing was probably a sub-six-figure Dominican signing. Especially since he only popped up in the Dominican Summer League when he was 20.
Yeah, I mean...
That's, like, a good outcome, though. That's a nice bit of scouting, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, you pop the... You know, he might have signed at 19, maybe, like, the winter before. He's a dude that got to double A, you know, for essentially what probably ended up being for his bonus the cost of a plane ticket. You know, it doesn't take much to consider it a baseball. Like, you can't, the thing is, like, you can't couch Tebow as a scouting success in the same way that Mikey De La Cruz was, though.
Right.
Because none of that played into it at any point in time. You weren't signing Tim Tebow, realistically, because you thought he'd even get to double A.
Probably not.
But, you know, more power to him. He's gonna, you know, I think as both Jared and I have said before, we're here at this point, he's gonna get Major League time, in all likelihood.
He might even... is there a chance that he sticks?
I don't think so. And the other thing is,
can he like have like a 3-year career as like a backup outfielder?
And like an up and down.
This is kind of like the reverse side of the. This is the reverse side of the Danny Heckmaria thing. Is that, you know?
So, ironically enough,
this guy is tough to carry too.
He's almost like last year would have been the year because the Mets actually have a decent amount of outfield depth now. Like he's, I don't think they can. You'll see how, right, like, how it plays out in Syracuse. It's going to be tough to get him up over Braxton Lee or Rajai Davis at this point, right, if they're clearing that 40 spot.
He could have been in that Jack Reinheimer spot in like the David Wright retirement game.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That never ended.
Yeah.
The worst game of baseball in the history of the universe.
Did you read Rachel McDaniel's piece on it?
This I did.
Like, yeah, yes. I know you did. I'm saying to our audience, if you haven't, it's quite good.
Yeah. As
everything she does, yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, is it like, does it, is it, has it been worthwhile from a baseball point of view? So like the thing is, these kind of wins are in the grand scheme of things so marginal that you can't sort of remove it from the context in which it happened. And I don't know if that context is good or bad. It's just unique.
Right.
You know, from a business standpoint, I would suggest that it's been wildly successful for both the Mets and minor league baseball as a whole. You know, Tim Tebow coming to town is, you know, July 4th fireworks night, Star Wars Day, wrapped up into every road trip, basically.
No, I believe this was on Baseball America, but there was a financial, there's been financial breakdowns, and this was like, you know, 7-8 figure impact on leagues that he was playing in terms of revenue.
I mean, we were there feelings. For the, was it Mother's Day weekend in Lakewood?
Yes.
And they you go there for those kind. Those aren't, you know, nobody's coming by after Mother's Day brunch on Sunday, normally.
Right, like a Sunday May game with no promotion is like, you know,
3,500,
4,000. On a good day.
Nice weather, yeah, maybe.
Right, instead they're getting 9 or 10.
Yeah. And they were lined up down the entire third baseline for autographs.
Yeah, all the fanny pack dudes.
Yeah.
Every fanny pack dude in the Northeast is there.
So I don't know. I haven't, like... this is like the third year of it now, functionally. So it just keeps getting weirder. Yeah, I guess.
Does he start back at Bingham, or do you think he's in Buffalo?
Syracuse.
Or Syracuse.
I like how you picked the one that wasn't either Vegas or Syracuse.
I know. I'll get that right eventually.
Buffalo is going back almost 10 years at this point. No, he starts in Syracuse for the exact reasons you think he's going to start in Syracuse the year after the Mets bought Syracuse.
Yeah. That's also a good college football market, too, right?
Yeah.
Like, that matters.
Sure.
Like, Bingham's not.
The other seven positions on the field where they're starting second baseman are not going to draw, so.
Yeah. Starting right fielder, Dylan Herrera.
Mm. So I think that's about it from the Facebook group at all.
Here's a question.
Yeah, sure.
If you're opening up a spot for a marginal utility guy that's mostly an infielder, why the fuck are you opening it for not opening it for Dylan Herrera, but opening it for Danny Hecuberea? Like, Dylan Herrera can stand at shortstop once every 2 weeks.
And they played him a little bit at shortstop, at least St. Lucie, I think.
Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. But,
I mean, they don't actually... Dylan Herrera is at the point in his career where he's not, like... He's still only... How old do you think Dylan Herrera is?
25.
Yeah, he's going to turn 25 before opening day. It's like, he's like crazy young still.
So...
I don't think there's a ton of upside there still because of the injuries, but... I mean, he wasn't an insignificant prospect.
But this kind of just like illustrates like the utter weirdness of like... Because my assumption... Given a Danny Hecuberea has an out clause, a Danny Hecuberea has a high base salary in his MLB thing, and the beats were immediately saying, he's got a great shot to make the opening day roster, guys. And he's like now in like all the roster projections. My assumption, based on the Mets' history, is they probably promised him playing time, or at least they promised him a strong shot at playing time.
Like, I just don't know how you carry that dude, given that they're going to have to carry. If we assume McNeil's starting, you've already... basically guaranteed spots to Broxton, Lagares, and Davis, and you got to carry a backup catcher, and there's your 12. That's your 12 position players right there. And that's before you get into how fast Pete Alonso might be up.
Pete Alonso, you've got TJ Rivera lurking around, you know.
Does Rivera have options left? I assume he does.
He does. Yeah. You've got the possibility that they decide to carry Darnold and Mesoraco.
Yeah. God bless
them. Like, where is this cut? Like, yeah. Like, I mean, okay, J.D. Davis has options. So you're sending J.D. Davis down. But you're sending J.D. Davis down to carry Adani Hecuberea. Who's your first bat off the bench against a right-handed pitcher then?
Left-handed pitcher.
No, a right-handed pitcher.
Oh, yeah,
on with a right-handed pitcher on the mound, you're going to have a bench of Lagares, Broxton, Hecuberea, and Darno. So it's your back catcher and three guys that are useless against righties.
Yeah.
Like, sub-replacement useless against righties.
That is a good point,
Jared. That's going to be a bench. That's, you're going to get mauled.
Every 95 and a slider righty is going to eat those dudes up, yes.
Right.
Do you want to talk about Nick Gage's weekend?
Yes, I want to some wrestling shows.
As you are wont to do?
I went to the ICW show at the Ultimate Fitness Queens.
Amazing. Yeah. I'm surprised it wasn't a used car lot. It's where they usually are in Queens.
Only took me 3 hours to get. No, this is apparently their new home base.
Yeah.
I always feel wonderful when the room you're in says fire capacity 250 and there's like at least 800 people in there.
Sounds about right for a New York City wrestling show.
This was literally the basketball court at the Ultimate Fitness Queens.
Mm.
This is not the world's nicest gym.
Yeah.
No offense if you're a member of the Ultimate Fitness Queens, which statistically it's likely that one or two of you are. This was like a bad indie show.
You go to a lot of them, Jarrett.
Right, but like a quarter of the crowd was like Queens Mongos and one quarter like irony people, like yeah. David Bixon's band, who was apparently there.
Apparently.
Apparently. Yeah, Nick Gage versus Scott Steiner was on the high side of exactly what you'd expect for Nick Gage versus Scott Steiner, complete with terrible finish because Scott Steiner wouldn't job to Nick Gage.
How mobile is Scott Steiner nowadays?
It was rough. I felt bad for him at times. Like, I didn't because he's Scott Steiner, but...
Yeah, yeah, you're right. How old is Scott Steiner nowadays?
Like, let's say. 50s, I think.
He is 56.
And, you know, he also was cutting promos on the crowd that were not suited for, you know, 2019.
Well, there's a shock.
So that was, it was an experience that I wanted to, you know, I enjoyed having that experience exactly once in my life. So then I went to the GCW show at the abandoned Showboat Casino and Hotel in Atlantic City. Which was honestly, I mean, this was one of the best live wrestling shows I've seen in years.
God bless Joey Janela.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he wasn't...
and he wasn't actually wrestling, but...
Right, he was commentating, although he did do a run-in at one point. Yeah, let's pull up the results and go through this on a match-by-match basis. So we had...
I'm really at the point where we're breaking down GCW cards match-by-match? All right, let's go right.
So ROH pulled Hot Sauce, so they did KTB versus Nate Webb, and I knew this was going to be fun when I had to vacate my seat three times during the course of the entrance and this match, because I was sitting in what turned out to be a bad spot for, you know, stuff. And, you know, that's a good match. And then there was Shane Mercer and Eli Everfly. Shane Mercer is going to get signed. He's a big jacked up dude who does some impressive power and speed stuff. Then they did Chris Dickinson and Tony Deppen, which was pretty good, which you'd imagine it would be. And then we started the death match portion of the card with Jimmy Lloyd, Eric Ryan, and Marcus Crane. Eric Crane like severed a bad artery in his arm and nearly bled out. They got him out of there. He was fine. He came out later. And then we had a six-way scramble match between Orange Cassidy, Jungle Boy, Grim Reefer, Facade, AJ Gray, and Teddy Hart.
It's quite the list of names.
If this match was on 205 Live, the people that claim they watch 205 Live would have been talking about it like a match of the year candidate. It, mind you, in no way was it like really a match of the year candidate, right. But it was like really, you know, they did a lot of really stupid stuff and wiped out a lot of fans doing dives into the crowd. The Showboat appeared to put no particular restriction on what they could do, so they were just like wiping out fans left and right and like, you know, death, like white tubes into the front row, yeah. Just like all kinds of shit. This was not a Showboat.
How is the Showboat nowadays?
I mean, it's the... I think it's going to reopen soon because, you know, all the old casino licenses are actually being bought back up for the sports betting.
Right.
Yeah, so they basically... They rented out the former High Limit Room, which has all the slots removed, which is right next to what used to be... Well, actually used to be and still is, like, the arcade.
Mm-hmm.
So the barriers in the arcade weren't actually that tall, so there's just, like, dozens of kids, like, looking over the barriers and, like, seeing this horrible deathmatch wrestling. Like, small kids, too.
It's
6, 7, 8 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we had G-Ray versus Matt Tremont. So, like, the first 5 minutes of the match, they were, like, intentionally not doing any deathmatch stuff and doing, like, Fat Man Lucha.
Sure.
And then they did the deathmatch stuff. We had Nick Gage versus Schlack. Five stars. I got to see Nick Gage stab a Nazi. Like, literally.
Yeah, no, yeah, I'm sure. I don't doubt that.
And then, but he did not beat the Nazi by stabbing him. He stabbed him to lead into his rolling pile driver finish. That by rolling pile driver, Nick Gage's finish is he hits a pile driver and rolls into another pile driver and does it like a Three Amigos pile driver, basically.
Sure.
It's not a Canadian destroyer. Now, mind you, there were like 26 Canadian destroyers.
Of course, it's an indie wrestling show in New Jersey.
I mean, literally, I think there were at least 15 in that six-way match alone. of various types. And then the main event was Jun Kasai against Alex Colon. Jun Kasai, unlike a lot of these dudes, can actually still go. To the extent that Jun Kasai could never.
He's not exactly like.
So somewhere in here we announced that GCW is going to Japan for a couple shots in August. Because my stupid little deathmatch promotion that draws 100 people in the Howl Game Changer world, you know, is now doing like 1,200 AC and running Japan. So it was an excellent show. But it was like a very specific kind of show. And, you know, something I took away from this, and this is something we've touched on in the past, but there's if you don't count any of the AEW guys, if you count the AEW guys as no longer indie guys signed with a major profession, there's like a legitimate argument that Nick Gage is now the top indie wrestler, like the top prestige indie guy.
Yeah, that's the case you can make.
That's like really not. Like it as is. we both watched CZW in like the early 2000s.
Oh yeah,
like,
I guess we did.
That's like really nuts to think about.
Like he was actually like legitimately not a particularly good. Like he was like a standard generic CZW deathmatch guy.
Before he came back the second time after he finally got out of jail for good, like his original run sucked, and his first comeback when he was out on parole for a little bit before he got sent back on a parole violation, he was terrible. And it's clear that a lot of him being terrible in both of those runs were because he had massive drug problems.
Right, yeah.
And he doesn't. He's clean now, apparently. But, you know, this is, you know, he's gotten really, he's like, you know, put aside the deathmatch stuff, he's one of the most effective babyface brawlers, like, in the entire business.
Yeah. What a world.
Yeah, like, this is, you know, he's one of the best promos in the business, too. Which is not something you would have, you know. He was always a pretty good promo, but, you know, and he has a connection with a certain group of fans that, you know, is unusual.
Sure.
He doesn't, you know, and it doesn't always come across but, you know, Nick Gage in that, like, CZW universe of, like, you know, people that, like, think they're ironic but are actually extremely earnest.
I mean,
I'm considering myself in that group.
Yes, of course.
Right, like, you know, you think you're ironic, but you're so ironic that you're actually incredibly earnest about the whole thing.
Sure.
But, and a lot of that is because there's an authenticity to that character that's not present in a lot of current wrestling. Which leads us to the WWE Elimination Chamber.
Yeah, it's all you, buddy.
Oh, God. I mean, so the weird thing is this show was actually, like, way better than I thought it was going to be, but I, like, could almost hope that it sucked, like, because I was, like, really excited for, like, that women's tag chamber to be, like, the worst match of the year, and it instead was just, like, okay to good. So the two main takeaways from this show for me were, one, they should have put the belt on Kofi Kingston. And WWE has a problem in that they change their minds all the time, but they never do it in such a way to pull the trigger on something organic that's happening. And this was one of like those organic moments, and you could tell it was happening on the SmackDown that they did the big, you know, hour-long run for him, and you could tell it was happening organically on social media all week. Like, people really wanted Kofi to finally get there, and they booked a match where it would have been perfect if he had just won at the end, and then he lost.
They do that a lot.
Right.
I'm trying to think of a match. Like,
remember that, like, and this was also with Daniel Bryan. This was during Daniel Bryan's heel run right before he got beat by Sheamus.
Hmm.
But they did, and they did this several times with this guy. They had Santino go in the Elimination Chamber and strongly teased that he was going to win the title over Bryan. And he didn't. And they also did it with Santino where they strongly teased that one year that he was going to win the Royal Rumble and he didn't.
Yeah, they just did it with Balor recently. They've done it with Strowman and Samoa Joe in the past.
Right, they did it with Balor at the Royal Rumble where, you know. And you can't have these big underdog stories, especially when you do two back-to-back, right, like Balor and Kofi. You're conditioning your fans not to believe in those guys.
I mean, you literally haven't ever put them over outside of the last Daniel Bryan run, they probably shouldn't.
Right, and you're conditioning your fans to get really emotionally invested in Kofi Kingston's big emotional journey, and then he just loses at the end to the heel's move, and there's no payoff? Like, if they bring this match back at WrestleMania, and they find a way to keep it hot for 6 weeks, and then Kofi wins and gets his big WrestleMania moment, but it doesn't seem like they're going in that direction.
They're probably not going to do that, no.
Right, they're going to do like a three-way with AJ Styles and Randy Orton, and Randy Orton's going to win his 13th world title or whatever, right?
Sure.
Like, that we're actually going here. But, you know, you can't, like, there's a limit to how many times you can, like, get the people to care and then invert it for heat, which leads us to the second thing that is worth talking about from this show. I'm not there yet, but I'm becoming more open to the idea that Dave Meltzer was actually right and the three-way is the right match to headline Mania. Because the segment they did with Becky Lynch destroying both of them was hotter than any of the, you know, was as hot or hotter than the previous stuff they'd done with just Becky and Ronda. So maybe that actually is the right dynamic.
Mm.
I still have reservations about them putting Becky over Charlotte instead of Ronda at the end, which I think would be a mistake.
Right.
I think this might end up being a really bad idea long term for Charlotte. I think this might typecast Charlotte in a bad way.
Right.
But purely for the build and what they're trying to accomplish with Becky, it might not be the worst idea, and it might also be a better match. Which is a lot of the argument that this might be a better match. You know, I'm not... Listen, so, you know, one of the arguments is that the Becky thing at this point is just so hot that they probably realistically can't screw it up unless they, like, really try. And they're still hitting most of the right notes here.
Yeah.
So...
It's just so weird to me to see sort of, I mean, we're about a... You know, functionally a year on from Ronda debuting, just seeing how different it is now.
Right, you know, and they burned... They overexposed Ronda, and they burned their crowd out on Ronda.
Yep.
That was...
Like, the problem with, like, WWE booking, in almost all cases, is you... If you're there long enough, you're just another wrestler.
But one of the smartest things they've done with Becky Lynch is she hasn't actually wrestled that much on TV since, like, August.
Yeah, you know, obviously they've done that with Brock, too. It's more of a function of Brock's schedule. And
there's certain reasons for that, but, like, so she loses the triple threat at SummerSlam.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't wrestle a match on TV between SummerSlam and Hell in the Cell, right?
Yeah.
So that's a month. She's doing stuff on TV, but there's no match. Between SummerSlam, between Hell in a Cell, so she does Hell in a Cell. She wins the title at Hell in a Cell. She squashes Lana on TV once. She has the rematch with Charlotte Super Showdown. They do a rematch of that match is on SmackDown and go to a double countout.
Mm-hmm.
They bring the match back at Evolution. So she's only wrestled two television matches in 2 months.
Yeah.
They do the match at Evolution. she doesn't wrestle again after Evolution on TV for 2 months because they were holding her off for the Rousey match, and then she got hurt. She got the concussion.
Right.
So she doesn't wrestle. So she wrestles once on TV between Evolution and TLC. She has that match with Nikki Cross.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not counting Tribute with the Troops. Tribute with the Troops doesn't really count.
Not in canon.
So, you know, after that, she has the match with she has a John Cena tag match. She has the number one contenders match. They have her wrestle one match against Peyton Royce, one match at Royal Rumble, and that's it. Yeah. She's wrestled like 7 times on TV since August.
And outside of like, you know, outside of Asuka, she's going over fairly emphatically in every case.
Right. Like, she's wrestled on SmackDown since August. Since SummerSlam, she has wrestled she's wrestled 5 TV matches since between August and February. 5. She's wrestled once a month on TV, which is about the right amount. That's about the right amount. If you were Hulk Hogan in the 1980s, you would wrestle about once a month on TV, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's actually the right amount. So they have figured that out with Becky Lynch, who seems to be, frankly, the only person in the entire promotion they care about pushing right now,
sure.
To be honest. And they're not wrong, either. They're not. But they have figured out that the most effective use of Becky Lynch is to have her run in and beat some people up or cut a cool promo.
Right.
Why can't they figure that out with everybody else?
I don't know, man. They kind of have figured it out for Strowman for a while.
But then they went back on it, and he's massively overexposed now. You know, I've been watching Raw out of the corner of my eye for a lot of this thing. We're 2 hours and 45 minutes in.
Yeah.
Becky Lynch hasn't actually shown up on Raw yet. Now, I assume that's about to happen in the main event set.
Right.
Because the main event is Ronda Rousey versus Ruby Riott, which is another thing. Why is Ronda Rousey wrestling Ruby Riott again after squashing her on the pay-per-view? Why is Ronda Rousey wrestling Ruby Riott on TV at all?
I like Ruby Riott. I think they're actually kind of misusing her. But...
Right, but like, why is Ronda wrestling on TV?
Right, yeah.
This is a bad idea. They're not stars when you do that.
Yeah.
They've made all of these characters very run-of-the-mill. So the big news today on Raw is that they called up Aleister Black, Ricochet, Johnny Gargano, and Tommaso Ciampa all on the Raw roster, which is, to me, the definition of our last round of call-ups didn't work. Holy shit, we need some dudes. So let's call up the actual good ones and stuff, right?
Yeah.
But there's clearly no planning here. Just kind of leave a couple hours before Raw.
Mm-hmm.
So they had Aleister Black pretty much squashed Elias. Which is fine, but they buried it in the third hour Raw, where nobody saw it. Ricochet's debut was as the hot tag guy in a match teaming with Finn Balor against Bobby Lashley and Leo Rush, and the match sucked. And DIY and Revival had like a bunch of like near 5-star matches, and then I just threw that match on with no build in the middle of Raw, with an announcement on WWE.com, and they had DIY work as, like, you know, baby faces, even though they're heels in NXT, and even though they're in, like, this reluctant feuding tag team role in NXT. They were just baby faces on the Raw roster. Like, Tommaso Ciampa, who's been built for 2 years as the ultimate heel in NXT, gets called up, and he's just a baby face doing his character from 2016. And, you know, you don't get chances to debut these guys that easily. You know, you can't get this first exposure again. And it's just, you know, there's, like, clearly no plan here. Like, you know, they kind of vaguely seem to be maybe hinting that Finn Balor and Ricochet is a WrestleMania direction for the IC title, which would be really great.
It's also going to get 12 minutes, so.
It's going to get 12 minutes, and the pegs Ricochet as an IC title level guy. You know, obviously, they had DIY beat the Revival clean, and the Rival is the tag team champion, so obviously they're running that match back for the titles. Johnny Gargano probably shouldn't be pegged as the second guy in a babyface tag team right now. You know, Aleister Black, we'll see. I think out of all of those guys, Vince is probably most likely to give Aleister Black a real push. For the obvious reasons, right?
Yeah.
The guy he should is Ricochet. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago when I saw that tag match, because this is three of those four guys. Oh. And honestly, Velveteen Dream's the one they probably really should have called up right now, but because that guy can be something. Yeah. And I think they push him. And I just, you know, they should run with Ricochet.
You right? Think?
Like Ricochet should be in the title match against Daniel Bryan. They don't have an obvious match. You know, they're going to run back a bad SmackDown program for the SmackDown title. Someone, AJ Styles and Randy Orton. And
they have, you know, no idea. AJ Styles is re-signing. And...
Right. Like, do something fresh. You know, do that big Kofi match. Do it, you know, put Ricochet or Johnny Gargano in that spot. Put Velveteen Dream in that spot. No, we're going to stay with the Pat Tand. And, you know, we only know how to book one angle for our top stars. So Becky Lynch now gets to pretend to be Steve Austin, which is fine. You know, it's, they're different enough personalities, and it's been long enough that it works fine. You know, Steve Austin gave his endorsement to her on his podcast anyway, so you're not going to get resentment from the Steve Austin fans, except for the ones that are going to just resent any woman wrestler, which are out there. But you know what? At this point, it's 2019, and fuck them, basically, right?
More or less.
Just fuck them. That's, yeah. There's going to be dudes that have meltdowns on Twitter because they're headlining WrestleMania with a women's match. And there's probably, and it might even be having a negative impact on business how hard they're pushing the women right now, but they got to do it anyway. And that's that.
And that seems like a good place to end.
Yeah. It's the right thing to do. And it's the right time to do it. Why is Ronda back to her regular gear? The Mortal Kombat gear was so much better. Anyway.
Ending the show, also the right thing to do and the right time to do it. So let Jarrett watch the main event of Raw like it's 1999. And we'll see you back here next week for another 2019 edition. For all you kids out there.